to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall, where we're going to be talking with Don Bradley, author of the book The Lost 116 Pages. It is a Greg Coford book. Thank you so much for being here, Don.
It's good to be here, Richie.
Now, tell me a little bit about you. Who is this Don Bradley that happened to have gotten the 116 pages from Martin Harris's wife and is able to be here? I'm kidding, of course.
Yeah, that's not exactly how it happened, but we can get into that. So I do Mormon history and study of Latter-day Saint scripture. My parents are both converts to the church, and so I grew up in it. In my adult life, I kind of have had a circuitous spiritual journey, kind of out and then back into the church.
Welcome actually, to the club. I also
you.
Have been
okay.
out and then been back in, for okay. sure.
Actually, the research that I did for this book was part of my journey back. I started that research 15 years ago. But I actually started doing archival research, original research in, you know, early church history as a teenager. I first went to the church archives when I was 17. And
so kind of a nerdy 17-year-old kid. No offense, of course.
Yeah, like I showed up at the church archives in a T-shirt and my knee-length shorts, you know, like almost every day after school, my senior year of high school. And I never saw then or since an unaccompanied teenager doing research there. But it seemed normal to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been at Mormon history research for a while and have just, I do sort of all things Joseph Smith. I'm fascinated with the origins of things, fascinated with the origins of my faith, and really dug in to figure out what's going on.
I think we're going to become fast friends. So to share something actually fairly personal, my patriarchal blessing talks about how sort of a kindred spirit with Joseph Smith. And then I had the opportunity to serve a mission in the Kirtland area.
Really?
So some really pretty unique experiences from starting my mission where you essentially make kind of an offering on the altar in the Newell K. Whitney store. That's how they do it in the Cleveland mission, which actually no longer exists anymore. It's been absorbed into other missions. To then 2 years later going back and reporting back to God and saying, hey, this is how I feel like I did. And just hearing the weeping of other elders and a feeling of fulfillment. But in to that point, I remember mornings where I was able to actually be in Kirtland. And it sounds hokey maybe, but feeling like or seeing like the spirits of the early saints.
Yeah.
And I'm not a person who says something
like
that, right? Like I am cynic of all cynics, but genuinely feeling like I could see that time in the history. So fast friends as far as a love and appreciation for that. Maybe I didn't hang out at the church history archives, but we can forgive that. Your book is called The Lost 116 Pages, which you say maybe it didn't work out exactly as I did it, but people will know, or at least the story within the church is Joseph and Martin Harris are they're translating the Book of Mormon, and Martin Harris's wife is saying, "Oh, what are you doing all this time? Where are you going? What's happening?" And comes to Joseph Smith and says, "Hey, can I show this to my wife?" And he's like, "No, but I'll ask God." And then just, you know, the answer is no, obviously, a couple times more. And then the permission is given for those translated pages to go with Martin Harris, who takes them to his wife, and she's able to see them. But then we never hear from them again. Mm-hmm. And rather than translate them again or anything like that, it's just sort of a foregone conclusion that we'll skip that part and jump to what we now have as First Nephi. So in that telling of the story, what am I getting wrong?
I mean, so yeah. So first, I mean, a quick clarification about the book. So yeah, this is not the actual lost 116 pages. This is like a scholar piecing together the puzzle pieces. What are the clues we've been left? So it's titled The Lost 116 Pages, Reconstructing the Book of Mormon's missing stories.
Hopefully people knew that. I was joking as far as that goes. I think we would have heard quite a bit more if we would have found the literal 160 pages.
There are people who claim to have found them, and there are people who claim to have had them like revealed to them. I'm not claiming either of those things. I'm claiming that I looked for the puzzle pieces, found a bunch, and have been able to put a lot of them together. So the story that you told, it's like fascinating, right? So why is Martin Harris so pushy, right? Why is he willing to pester God over and over? And then like, you know, what happens to the pages? Of course, the story that you alluded to, the common story, right, is, well, Lucy Harris took them, you know, and then another common part of it is she burned them, you know. And actually, we can call that into question, and we can explain why things like why is Martin Harris so pushy. So in my book,
why was Martin Harris so pushy?
I'll tell you. Just so you know, in my book, the book is in two parts. So part one, I would call the history of the lost pages. Part two is the history in the lost pages. So what do we know about what was in them? So in this history of the lost pages, one of the questions is, why is Martin Harris so pushy? So the thing is, none of the sources actually come out and say, okay, here's exactly what was going on with Martin Harris. Here's why he's so desperate, you know. But we've got enough of the information that if we just line up the events in the right order, we can actually see how they relate and what the story is, what happened. A lot of history is actually just get things in the right order, and then you can sort of watch the dominoes fall. Okay? So what happens is Joseph Smith tells us Martin is taking dictation for him, right, acting as a scribe on these pages from the middle of April to the middle of June that year, 1828. So if you look at, we know, you know, a couple things about Martin Harris, big things. One is he's got money, right?
Yeah.
He helps finance the publication of the book. Why does he have money? He's a prosperous farmer. So when was the planting season that year in upstate New York where he's a farmer?
Would have been April through June.
Mid-April through mid-June. It's the exact time that Martin Harris is gone from his farm down in Pennsylvania to take dictation for Joseph on this book. Then when we line up the clues, right, we've also got a family event, major family event. Martin Harris's oldest daughter, first child to get married, gets married in Palmyra on May 8th. So Martin is down in Pennsylvania from April to June. Guess who's not at his own daughter's wedding, right? Mm. So Martin Harris, to take dictation for this manuscript, Martin Harris misses the entire planting season on his farm and his own daughter's wedding. Mm. Do you think he can go home after that empty-handed and say, no, if you could only see this manuscript, then you would understand why this is so important? He can't. He has to have something. If you're making that level of sacrifice, right, for your family, like of your family, right, for something, you've got to have something to show for it. So he just feels like he cannot go home empty-handed. So he's just going to push and push until he gets permission to take that manuscript. And after the third time, finally, he does.
What do we know of the character of Lucy Harris? I know, sort of as a funny anecdote, a few years back there was a T-shirt that was made that said Martin Harris's wife is a jerk, and we sort of shared it, you know, as a little, you know, poke, a little laugh maybe, but certainly, you know, through the telling of the story, I think that that's the brush with which she is painted, which, you know, she doesn't understand the greater calling. She's of limited vision. She doesn't have faith. What do we know, whether from her own words or from Martin's words or other folks, about how she was? Was Martin placing this pressure on himself, or was she very much like that?
Oh, no, he was right to think that there was that pressure on him under these circumstances. She was a complex character. I mean, she comes out in my research looking a lot better than a lot of the sort of folklore stories. But she, for one thing, she's an extremely devout Quaker. So this is a very, very devoutly religious woman. She's also like a very practical woman. And so she's really concerned for the financial security of the family, right? And this is why she doesn't want Martin investing his time or the family's money in this book. That concerns her greatly. We also know, this is something that I think puts her in a more sympathetic light, kind of her suspicions. She was suspicious that Joseph Smith was trying to, you know, bilk her husband out of her family, out of this money, you know. Lucy Mack Smith gives us, Joseph's mother, gives us a really interesting insight into her. She talks about how Lucy Harris was hard of hearing. She apparently had progressive hearing loss. Hmm. She was still a young woman at this time. She was just like in her early 30s at this point, but she had progressive hearing loss. And there's actually current research today that shows that progressive hearing loss actually often produces paranoia.
Interesting.
That as people start not being able to hear people around them, they start assuming that people are talking quieter, that people are whispering behind their back. They become really suspicious. They think their people are in conspiracy against them. And that Lucy Mack Smith actually, she wouldn't have known about this research today, but she actually made that connection. Like in her family memoir, when she writes about Lucy Harris, she writes that she was losing her hearing and that that made her really suspicious of people. Mm. And so, you know, that's something that we know about her. She was one of the neighbors said she was very, in his words, very high in combativeness. Mm. So she would really stand her ground. She would fight, right? Mm-hmm. And Lucy Mack Smith, sort of as a mom might, being very like protective of her son Joseph,
right.
She actually cast Lucy Harris as almost like a demonic sort of figure, right? She thought that Lucy Harris was drumming up all these conspiracies against Joseph and so on. One of the things that comes out in my research, like a source that's never been used before, is actually from it's a journal of someone who wrote things that he heard from Martin Harris Jr.
Okay.
This is Martin Harris's son. And Martin Harris's son said that his father had told him many times the story of the manuscript loss. And you know, basically the story is that the manuscript had been locked in Lucy Harris's bureau that she had the key to. And it doesn't disappear while it's in her bureau. But she's away. She's like out of town. And somebody comes to visit Martin and he wants to show this guy the manuscript. So he breaks into the bureau and he actually damages it in the process. She's upset about this later. But then he puts it in his own drawer, locks it up. He goes out of town for a couple days. He comes back, and the manuscript is gone. Mm. The drawer is locked. There's no sign of tampering, but there's no manuscript. He never sees it again. He first assumes his wife had to have been involved in the theft, and this actually blows up their marriage, right? The conflict over this. So they don't divorce, but they are separated for 8 years until she dies.
Oh, wow.
Just
to follow up real quick, dies having never joined the church, I would
presume. Oh, no. She ended up very much against it.
Yeah.
She ends up very sour on it. And actually, Martin's blaming of her for taking the manuscript seems to be sort of the thing that really pushes her over the edge from being skeptical of this whole thing to being just outright against it.
Hmm.
But the new thing that this journal shows is that when she's on her deathbed, she tells her children that she didn't know anything about what happened to the manuscript.
Hmm.
She knows nothing about where it is. So Martin, who initially suspected her of the theft, becomes absolutely convinced that she didn't have anything to do with it. So you have to understand, so in the Quaker faith, lying is like a huge sin,
sure.
Right? Your every word is supposed to be the same as if you were under oath. You're not allowed to take oaths if you're a Quaker, mm-hmm. because every word you speak is basically supposed to be like an oath. And so that she would lie, she would say this on her deathbed, right? Like,
yeah,
he just couldn't bring himself
lying.
To believe
yeah, exactly.
that this devout Quaker wife of his would lie on her deathbed.
Huh.
And so he then becomes totally confused, like, well, who took this? And he doesn't know.
So that time when she's away and he's away takes place within the narrative of Martin coming back to be with her in the midst
yeah.
of the translation.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Huh. Right. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear a story that I have been told literally my entire life,
yeah.
you know, at being a lifelong member, although not technically for about 10 years, but you know, being rebaptized and joining the faith again. But to have this context given to the story that, mm-hmm. that allows me to more fully understand the situation. It's just fascinating to
yeah.
me. What this book, The Lost 116 Pages, can kind of shed light to. I want to take a break for a quick second,
sure.
and when we come back, I want to pick up any other pieces that might be necessary for us as we kind of contextualize the loss of those 116 pages. But then I also want to get into what you speculate might be contained within those lost 116 pages.
Sure.
We'll get back to that in the second block of the Cultural Hall. I want to take a quick second and talk to you about Best DJ in Utah now in its second year. Last year, I went to Washington, to Roche Harbor, and did a gorgeous wedding. This year, I'm slated to go to Moab, to go to Denver to do weddings. And guys, it couldn't be going any better. Thanks in large part to folks like yourself, people who are listening to this and say, you know what, I need a wedding or a mobile DJ for something, and then reach out to me. You can go to bestdjinutah.com. You can find me on all of the social medias at Richie T. Stedman, or you can certainly just send me an email, Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E-T as in tough guy, Stedman, S-T-E-A-D-M-A-N @gmail.com. I would love to see what I could do to make your event that much better. Whether it's a party or the biggest day of your life, you need the best DJ in Utah. And like I said, it doesn't have to be in Utah. It can just be the best DJ in Utah. I don't know. Now we start to get into like the technical things. It's bestdjinutah.com.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Time for the second block of the Cultural Hall. Let's pick up any other pieces. Is there anything else contextually wise around that time that we should understand about the whether the it's the 116 pages or the loss of said pages to really help us understand that portion?
Yeah, so you mean not necessarily about the theft or
I mean if there are parts of the theft that are missing or around Joseph Smith and
yeah.
the releasing of the 116
there are plenty
pages
of things, yeah. So I mean one more quick thing about the theft would be there's a lot of evidence about the theft, and it's interesting how much of that evidence actually weighs against Lucy Harris having been the thief. She might have been, but the evidence really doesn't line up well for it. If I've taken the sources that I've been able to find about the theft, about 40-some-odd sources, and I've lined them up in chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, interesting patterns emerge. So one pattern is the first time anyone says in print that they thought that Lucy Harris stole the manuscript and burned it, it's a quarter of a century after the fact, And they admit that they're just speculating, that they don't know. They're just guessing. Mm-hmm. Then somebody else repeats that and repeats it a little more definitely. And then somebody else repeats it much more definitely. And basically, the further you get from the actual theft, the more likely people are to say Lucy Harris took the manuscript and burned it. The
sure.
further you get,
telephone.
Right?
Telephone.
So, yeah, that calls that whole thing into question. Now, you know, another really interesting thing about like this time period and the emergence of these pages is the role that Emma Smith plays in the process. So if we look at the early sources, they actually tell us who the scribes were for the lost pages. And we've known for a long time that Emma Smith was one of the scribes for the Book of Mormon, mm-hmm. but people haven't really known which part was she a scribe for. She actually gives us enough information in her interviews that she gave where we can identify where she was the scribe. She talks about, you know, Joseph couldn't pronounce the name Sariah correctly when she was scribing for him.
Which gives us a nod, right. obviously, to certainly Lehi and, right. and Nephi, sure.
Right. And then the Jerusalem having walls, like when Joseph dictates that part of the translation, he's like, wait a minute, Emma, did Jerusalem really have walls? And she had to show him in the Bible where it said Jerusalem had walls. Mm-hmm. So both those things show up early in 1 Nephi. But here's the thing. We have the full manuscript of 1 Nephi, and it's not in Emma's handwriting. Hmm. It's in Oliver Cowdery's and some of the Whitmer's handwriting. We also know Emma wasn't there at the time that was dictated, because Joseph had just moved up to Fayette and left her down in New York and left her down in Pennsylvania for a little while. And the name Sariah and the mention of the walls of Jerusalem in the story about Nephi getting the brass plates would have first come up not in 1 Nephi, but in the Book of Lehi at the beginning of the Lost Pages. So Joseph's very first scribe for the Book of Mormon, for the first part of the Lost Pages, was Emma. So at the beginning, it's husband and wife working on this together, which is, I think, fascinating.
Yeah, and kind of romantic, too.
Yeah.
It's kind of, right?
Yeah.
In a spiritual romance.
Right.
So that obviously is interesting to note. So you made this just sort of as kind of a side note, but you said that there have been people that have said these are the lost 116 pages. As those things have come out, is there anything worth discussing among those, or have those all pretty well just been dismissed as this is clearly not this, or this is just someone seeking to do damage to the church?
Yeah, I haven't seen any good. I would love to have that manuscript show up. This would be like the holy grail of Mormon history, right? It would be one of the biggest finds ever in religious history, and certainly in Latter-day Saint history. But I haven't seen anything that would indicate that anybody's actually really found them. Hopefully, they still exist somewhere. But if they do, it's in somebody's attic or something.
I was going to say, it's rolled up somewhere in the back corner of a home that it hasn't been looked in. And yeah, can you imagine?
Yeah, it would be huge. Because actually, the Lost Pages of the Book of Mormon, they're the earliest Latter-day Saint scripture. Mm-hmm. So the part of the Book of Mormon that we have is translated after the loss of the manuscript.
Right.
The earliest revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants is section 3, and that revelation is given right after and in response to the manuscript loss. Mm-hmm. So that's the earliest revelation to Joseph Smith that we have, but the Lost Pages were earlier. So like the original Mormon scripture, gone.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point to transition then. So what's in those 116 pages? Certainly the story of Lehi leaving Jerusalem, as we learn from our study of Nephi. He basically is like, well, I don't know really why, but I guess I'm going to do the same thing that my dad did.
Yeah.
What else have you gleaned from your study in the preparation of this book of what might those 116 pages contain?
Yeah, so first, there are all kinds of surprises. There certainly have been for me in this research when it comes to looking at what we can know about the lost pages. So first off, even though I use the term the lost 116 pages, and that's the term that I've used as the title of my book because it's such a recognizable name mm-hmm. for this manuscript, there's reason to think it was actually longer than that.
Why is that?
So there are several reasons. So one of them would be that Martin Harris had a brother, Emer Harris, who joined the church, came out to Utah as a 1847 pioneer. I was right here in Provo, in fact. And on April 6th, 1856, there was a state conference here, and Emer Harris was asked to speak about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and the rise of the church, and he was there for all this, mm-hmm. you know. He's also, I should mention, actually, he's a direct ancestor of Dallin Harris Oaks, which is what the H stands for.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So some deep connections there. So Martin's brother talks a little bit about the lost pages. He says a little bit of what was in them. But he also tells the story about Martin losing the manuscript. And he says in his sermon that Martin had scribed for, his words, near 200 pages of the manuscript before Martin lost it. So if the manuscript was only 116 pages, how could Martin have scribed nearly 200 pages of it, right?
Sure.
That wouldn't compute. Also, Martin Harris was not the first scribe on that manuscript, right? So like Emma had scribed, two of her brothers, and Joseph's brother Samuel. So if you've got four scribes before Martin, mm-hmm. and Martin scribes near 200 pages, there's well over 200 pages in that manuscript. And there are other lines of evidence pointing to this. For instance, you know, I mentioned earlier, Joseph said Martin was scribing for, he gives dates that Martin was scribing between, and it comes out to 64 days.
Right.
So if you look at what Joseph's translation rate is for the part of the Book of Mormon we have, if Martin was only producing some portion of 116 pages after these four other scribes worked on part of it as well, then Joseph had to be translating at something like 1/6 the rate for the lost manuscript that he translated at for the manuscript that we have.
Right, which even taking into account, like, he was new at it.
Yeah.
You know, even if there's, like, the learning curve of, like, okay, how does this transcribing go? And now I'm starting to function at it a little bit better, and now I can do it in a regular rate and speed.
Yeah.
That's still pretty slow.
It would be a huge increase in his speed. And there are a few other lines of evidence that consistently, every line of evidence that I can find, and there are about five of them, all point to the manuscript being at least 200 pages. Mm. And then actually,
where do we get the number 116 then?
Okay, so interestingly, we get it from Joseph Smith.
Okay.
But previous scholars actually have suggested why Joseph uses that number. If you look at the earliest complete manuscript of the Book of Mormon we have, the printer's manuscript, mm-hmm. and you look at the part of the Book of Mormon that replaces the lost pages. That's the small plates. Mm-hmm. So Joseph tells us, and Section 10 of the Doctrine and Covenants tells us, like, the lost manuscript had gone from Lehi down to King Benjamin.
Right.
Then it's stolen. Something has to be put in its place. So the Lord tells him, put the small plates of Nephi in there, okay? If you look at the length of that replacement text in the manuscript, it's exactly 116 pages.
Oh, interesting.
So scholars have looked at this before, and they've been like, wait a minute. The lost manuscript and the manuscript that replaced it were exactly, both of them, exactly 116 pages? Hmm. And they shouldn't be the same length, because the small plates tells us that it's actually a much shorter account.
Yeah, it's an abridged version of the things that were shared before.
Right, so the lost manuscript should be longer. So when Joseph is writing a preface to the 1830 Book of Mormon, he's got to write some explanation. Because if you think about this, right, when nobody knows the story of the lost manuscript, the first people, this book is going to start to circulate, people are going to read it, they're not necessarily going to have other people to explain it to them, because mm-hmm. it's a brand new thing. They would look at the title page of the book, and it would say, the Book of Mormon, written by the hand of Mormon. They would turn the page. There's no explanatory preface. They would turn the page. I, Nephi. Well, wait, where did Mormon go?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, I thought this was the Book of Mormon, written by Mormon, and then I turned the page, and without any explanation at all, it's Nephi. So Joseph Smith adds a preface, and in that preface he explains, well, there was this manuscript. It was Mormon's abridgment of the first part of Nephite history, from Lehi down to King Benjamin. Mm-hmm. It's stolen, and he says it was 116 pages of manuscript. It's stolen. God gave me this revelation, told me to replace it with these other plates. And so why does he use the number 116? It looks like he just borrows it. He doesn't know the length of the manuscript.
Right.
And he needs some way of estimating it. So he looks, oh, okay, well, what's the length of the part that replaces it? That's 116 pages. That's good enough.
Sure.
As an estimate. Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
And for a lot of people, that'll be the first time they've ever even thought of whether or not the manuscript was 116 pages or 200 pages or for whatever that is. I'm going to pay you the biggest compliment, and it may not sound like a compliment, but this is so nerdy, and I love it. I love it so much. Yeah. Like, this to me is the stuff where, like, when you talk about lining stuff out chronologically and prepping context, and this is what people say, like, I'm just like, this is the kind of stuff I just want to shout at people, don't you realize? And for some, I think that they can really get on board, and that's why I think that, you know, the book The Lost 116 Pages is really for. And then there'll be other people that'll just dismiss it and be like, yeah, but do you have a testimony of it? And that's fine, you know, move along. What other things, because I want to know a few more sort of juicy tidbits.
Sure.
And obviously, I encourage people to get the book, because you're not going to be able to do the book justice in the time that we have to talk. But what other things were you able to kind of piece together and be like, oh, that was probably in that first bit?
Yeah. Well, let me comment first. You mentioned like people are going to have different levels of interest, right? Because I remember being curious about what was in these pages when I was 10 years old and I was in primary, mm-hmm. and my primary teacher taught us this story. And I was like, wait, we're missing part of the Book of Mormon?
Right.
Like, what was in it?
Let's
go
find it.
Right, if you're a Latter-day Saint child, like, nothing is more foundational to your faith than the Book of Mormon. Like, how can part of it be gone, right?
Yeah.
But then what actually prompted me to start researching it as an adult was that I wanted to understand. It wasn't just that curiosity. It was definitely that. But it was also, I started to realize that if I wanted to understand the part of the Book of Mormon that we have, I needed to understand more about the part that is missing.
Yeah.
Because, like, imagine that you've got any complex narrative or, you know, lengthy book, right? War and Peace, you know, heck, Harry Potter, right?
Sure.
And, like, you've never read it before, and somebody just, like, takes the book and sort of like rips out the first half, you know.
Yeah, and then just says Harry is a wizard, kind
right,
of.
Right, and just sort of right. Here's thumbnail sketch, you know, Cliff Notes or whatever, Spark Notes version briefly, and then here, read the rest of this.
Yeah,
how much sense is it going to make compared to if you had the whole thing?
Yeah,
right.
Mm.
And so I started recognizing that in Mormon's narrative, he's often alluding back to things earlier. And if we want to understand what he's saying in the text we have, we got to know something about what he was saying earlier, or what we've got is not going to make sense.
With the amount of value placed on that, though, you would think that on some line that a narrative from God would be like, hey, just retranslate these things, you know, because it wasn't like the plates were taken away from Joseph, and even as I understand it, it was the choice so that things couldn't be made fraudulent as far as the manuscript would be, right? It wasn't like God said, hey, don't go back and translate. Joseph just was like, well, this is going to be too much
for opponents of
the church. Or was it God that
actually,
said, hey, don't
do that? Actually, it's God.
Okay.
So it's actually section 10 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Joseph doesn't know at first what he's supposed to do about the missing manuscript. Section 10 comes in and it says, okay, here's what you got to do.
It paraphrasing, says, of course, because God was never like, okay,
thus saith the Lord, what you got to do. It says that there was a conspiracy against the manuscript, against the Book of Mormon, that the manuscript had been, like, the words had been altered, it had been doctored. And if Joseph retranslated the same thing, like, people would produce a variant manuscript that wouldn't be the same thing. I mean, there are actually also questions about, given the way that translation works, given the way that revelation works, right? And if Joseph Smith is supposed to be able, is supposed to, like, be translating by studying this out in his mind, the words are not going to come out the exact same way. Like anytime you've got a human being choosing a bunch of words to express a meaning, and you've got hundreds of thousands of words that need to be replaced, they're not going to come out exactly the same. They're not going to match. And so rather than have, you know, a problem for one reason or another with just some degree of mismatch that could be used then against the Book of Mormon, the instruction is, there are these small plates. That'll do good enough. Now, I personally think that, as I've done this research, there are such remarkable sources, historical sources that have been preserved, which I'll talk about here, that tell us some of what's in those lost pages. And so I've heard people say, kind of like, well, I figure that, like, God told us sort of, if God wanted us to know what was in the lost pages, he would have, like, preserved those lost pages. As far as I'm concerned, if God didn't want us to know a good deal of what was in those lost pages, he would have made it so that there aren't a number of historical sources that tell us a lot of what was in those pages, right? So an example, my favorite source from this period is Joseph Smith Sr. did an interview. It's known but not well known. So in 1830, Book of Mormon is at the press, but it's not fully bound yet and sold. So there are a couple young men in Palmyra who they are hearing the buzz in town about this book, but they can't read it yet.
Right.
So they do what I would have done. They show up at Joseph Smith Sr.'s door and they ask, like, tell us about this book. And he tells them the story of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon with details that, like, show that they really got inside information, because they published one of these guys publishes an account of this interview long before other things are published that give some of the same details, right? So we know the guy's got inside information. His name was Fayette Latham. God bless him, right? Because he, like, preserved all this information. He was never Mormon. Joseph Smith Sr. tells him about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, and he starts telling him the story in the Book of Mormon. And, like, some of the details are garbled, right? It's clear he didn't understand everything he was told by Joseph Sr. But we can kind of identify where, okay, he's saying that the Liahona actually, like, he knows that there was this ball that they're being led by on their exodus through the wilderness. But he doesn't understand that it's like it works like a compass. He actually thinks that the way that it directs them through the wilderness is it, like, floats in the air in front of them, and they follow it.
Which is pretty awesome, but not how it works.
Yeah, not how it worked, right? But you can see how, like, he's told, this ball guides them through the wilderness. And he's like, oh, okay, this ball's floating through the air through the wilderness, and they follow it. So he gets some things garbled, right? But overall, he tells the familiar story. So he's like, well, there's this. He doesn't remember a single name, which is he never reads the book. He just hears the story, right, from Joseph Sr. So there's this prophet. God warns him to get out of town because, you know, the city's going to be destroyed. And he takes his family and they go out into the wilderness and they travel by the Red Sea and they travel 3 days. And then they stop and God says, go back and get this record. You know, and he sends his son. Now, the guy only remembers one son, but, like, Nephi plays the lead role here, right? And, like, he goes back into the city, and he finds the possessor of this record, but the guy won't give it to him. And then he goes back again, and he finds the guy drunk on the ground, and he draws his sword. And, like, the guy, he even remembers a comment about, like, the beauty of the hilt of the sword, right? And then he chops the guy's head off with the sword, and he gets the record and so on. This is obviously the familiar story. Like I said, he gets some details garbled. He also adds a detail that's not in our story in 1 Nephi, but it would fit, like hand in glove. It would fit perfectly. So he says...
I'm leaning in. Okay?
Excuse me. He says that the guy, Laban, was drunk because there was a great feast being celebrated in Jerusalem at the time. So think like a Jewish festival, mm-hmm. right? So the Book of Mormon text that we have, 1 Nephi doesn't say this. It doesn't say why Laban was drunk, but it says things that would fit with this. So for instance, who is Laban with? What's Laban been doing? 1 Nephi says he'd been out by night with the elders of the Jews. These are some pretty high-profile drinking buddies, if that's right. all this is, right? Is right. out at night with the elders, right? Like, and
I love that context.
He also
some
goes out
great drinking buddies, you know,
right?
Yeah,
he also goes out drinking, wearing armor and carrying a sword. Like he's kind of like formally dressed, like more like a
like
ceremonial
you would be for
occasion
a celebration.
Than going out with the guys, right? Then he comes back. Well. Nephi goes in disguised as him, right, and talks to the Zoram, who's got the, you know, charge of the plates. And he's like, yeah, we're going to go out to the elders, and we're going to bring these plates. And Zoram, like, doesn't bat an eye. Like, this is apparently, like, seems like a normal request to him. Well, I don't know. If Laban's just out getting drunk with his buddies, yeah, let's go bring the scriptures out, you know.
Right.
That'd be a little weird. But if... As Joseph Smith Sr. says here, there's a religious festival going on. Ah, then all these details start to make sense. He's out at night with the elders. There's something formal about this occasion. It's not surprising he wants to take the scriptures out as part of this, right? And then there are other things in the narrative that this would explain, even the timing that's given. When Nephi talks about how this all occurs, in the commencement of the first year of the reign of Zedekiah, the Bible and Babylonian records both tell us exactly when Zedekiah's reign begins. And it's basically at the exact beginning of the Jewish calendar year, which started with the month of Nisan. Well, that's the month of Passover.
Hmm.
So this would fit beautifully with, there was a feast going on. It was Passover. And then there are things about this narrative, even things in the words that the Spirit says to Nephi when he tells him to kill Laban, that actually fit beautifully, that they make a lot more sense once you put them in this context of Passover.
Hmm.
And so, you know, our Book of Mormon text doesn't say, oh, there's a feast, oh, there's Passover.
Right.
But this interview where Joseph Smith Sr. is telling a narrative of the first part of Lehi's and Nephi's story has this detail that would fit beautifully, make sense of a lot of things. This interview has several things like that, where there are things that our Book of Mormon text hints at, but doesn't actually say. And then in this one, he comes out and he says it. And he, in a couple cases, he gives stories, whole stories, that aren't in our Book of Mormon text, but they just fit beautifully. So like the coolest example of this for me is he gives a narrative that answers one of the unanswered questions in the Book of Mormon.
This is Joseph Smith Sr.
Joseph Smith Sr.
In this interview.
In this interview. So,
Question around that. So is the purporting that then Joseph Smith Jr. would have at some point told Joseph Smith Sr. about this?
Okay. Yeah. And part of the reason to think also that he is relating details from the Lost Pages is that Joseph Smith Sr. is in this interview, is that if you look at how much of the Book of Mormon narrative he covers and how heavily he covers it in this interview, when he's talking about parts that would have been covered in the Lost Pages, he talks about it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Once he gets done with the Lost Pages period to the part of the Book of Mormon, Mormon's Abridgment that comes after that, it basically sums it up in like two sentences.
Right.
And he says, like,
there was wars, and then people
died.
That's
what he says. He says, they had lots of wars. Jesus came. They like divided into tribes and killed themselves off. That's basically his whole narrative of like after the Lost Pages. But when he's talking about the period that would have been covered by the Lost Pages, he gives a host of details and some new details that would fit. They're just not in our book.
Right.
Right.
And I interrupted you as you were going into
so,
that.
So the coolest story, this one actually just like completely blew my mind. And in sort of complex ways, this was part of what was involved in my return to the church, because it had so many implications to me for understanding the Book of Mormon, for understanding Joseph Smith, and just all kinds of things, the temple, all kinds of things. So, we talk about the Nephites having kind of like a Urim and Thummim. The Book of Mormon calls it the interpreters, right? And Joseph Smith later has this actually use their accounts where he uses it to translate part of the Lost Pages.
Right.
And their accounts I talk about in the book of exactly how this instrument worked and stuff. Really cool. But we know from our Book of Mormon text that we have where these interpreters come from, or at least we know how the Jaredites get them. So the brother of Jared, he's on like an Exodus away from the Tower of Babel. And he goes up on top of this mountain. And the Lord gives him these two stones, the interpreters, right? So then later on, we know like some of the Nephite kings and then prophets have these same interpreters. So King Mosiah II has them. His dad, King Benjamin, has them. It's implied that his dad, King Mosiah I, whose story is mostly in the Lost Pages, so we just have a thumbnail sketch of it, small plates, it's implied that he had them as well. But then we're never told, how did they get them? Like, we know how the Jaredites got them.
Right, but
how did
they get them
from the... That doesn't explain how the Nephites got them.
Yeah, if they're, in fact, the same thing, how did they get them from
the Jaredites? And we know that they're the same thing, actually, because Section 17 of the Doctrine and Covenants says that those interpreters were the same interpreters given to the brother of Jared on the mountain.
So how'd they get them?
So how'd they get them? So our Book of Mormon doesn't say... But Joseph Smith Sr. gives a lengthy narrative to this interviewer exactly about how the Nephites got the Jaredite interpreters.
I'm listening. Okay?
So what he says is that after they get to the New World, and he doesn't say exactly how long, but sometime after they're in their new promised land, they're on an exodus. They're like journeying. So kind of like, well, obviously like Moses and the Israelites, but also like Lehi and Nephi, right, on their exodus from Jerusalem to their promised land. They're on a new exodus in the New World, and they are being led by the Liahona. And actually, there is an exodus that we know of after they get to the New World, and that's King Mosiah I, Benjamin's dad. Okay? So the Book of Omni gives us the thumbnail sketch version of this. So they go on an exodus from the land of Nephi to the land of Zarahemla. So in Joseph Smith Sr.'s narrative, he doesn't say exactly where they're traveling, but this is presumably that event. They're on an exodus. Their leader's being led by the Liahona. The Liahona leads him to an object. It's this weird object, and he doesn't know why he's been led to it. He doesn't know what it's for. He doesn't know how to use it. Mm-hmm. God led him to this for some reason, but what? Hmm. So they have a tabernacle. So this is like in the Bible, right? In Moses' Exodus, this is like the portable version of the temple, right? So they're on their own exodus. They've got a tabernacle, portable temple, being led by the Liahona. He was led to this object. He takes the object, carries it into the tabernacle. Voice of God, so the presence of God is understood in the Jewish temple or tabernacle to be in the Holy of Holies, behind the veil there. Voice of God asks him, "What is that in your hand?" And the guy answers, the prophet answers, he did not know, but had come to inquire.
Hmm.
And then the Lord tells him, put it on your face and cover your face with an animal skin. And he does. And once he does, he can see anything. It's the interpreters. That's the object he's been led to.
Yeah.
So once that happens, the Liahona stops working. They no longer use, in this account from Joseph Smith, the Liahona stops working. They no longer use the Liahona. They just use the interpreters. Okay. There's so much about this story that it's like hard to know where to start commenting.
Right, right, right.
So like, first of all, like I mentioned, Book of Mormon raises questions sometimes that it doesn't answer.
Sure.
Raises this question, how the Nephites get the interpreters? Well, this story, actually answers, gives an answer, yeah. right? Well, here's how the Nephites got the interpreters. Book of Mormon, another question scholars have pointed out, Book of Mormon raises, but doesn't answer, our Book of Mormon text at least, raises, but doesn't answer, is why don't the Nephites keep using the Liahona?
Right.
So think about, there are times when they're traveling in the New World.
They could have really benefited right. from a Liahona saying, this way, right. turn left, turn
they,
right.
They yeah. send an expedition down in first part of the Book of Mosiah, down to find the Zenith colony that had disappeared, gone down to the land of Nephi. They didn't know how to get there anymore. And it says they didn't know what they were doing, and so they wandered in the wilderness for a long time. Well, kind of would have been handy to have a Liahona,
sure.
right? All those wars, they're traveling in the wilderness, they didn't know which way do we go to get away from the Lamanites, to find the Lamanites. They're never using the Liahona.
Right.
Well, what does this narrative from Joseph Smith Sr. tell us? Joseph Smith Sr. says, Liahona didn't work anymore. Once they got the interpreters, Liahona stopped working. So this, he gives a narrative that answers two, not one, but two
sure.
questions that our Book of Mormon text raises, doesn't answer. Then also, this narrative has so many earmarks of Book of Mormon narrative. So narratives of the Book of Mormon, they tend to have, for one thing, a lot of complexity. There are a lot of echoes of the Bible. So Lehi's Exodus actually has a lot of, several papers have been written about how it has a lot of echoes of Moses's Exodus.
Sure.
Lehi's like a new Moses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this narrative that Joseph Smith Sr. gives about the interpreters has three different elements that echo the story of Moses' exodus and stopping at Mount Sinai.
Hmm.
So, first of all, that question that the Lord asks in this narrative, what is that in your hand? That's Exodus 3. That's Moses at the burning bush on Mount Sinai. God asks him, what is that in your hand? It's his rod that mm-hmm. he has in his hand, right? Moses is told by the Lord to veil his face. After he comes down from Sinai, his face is shining, so he veils his face. In this narrative, when the guy puts on the interpreters, he veils his face, mm-hmm. just like Moses, mm-hmm. right? They have a tabernacle. Where in the Bible narrative, in the Exodus narrative, do they build the tabernacle? At Mount Sinai.
Right.
That's where that comes from.
Right.
So there are all these Exodus Sinai echoes, just like in the narratives of the Book of Mormon we have. There's like a typology, right? Like sacred history, like repeats, you know? This story is just like that, just like Book of Mormon narratives that we have. And then there are like parallels to Joseph Smith's practice as a seer. So a lot of people know, and a lot of people actually are disturbed by the fact that like for part of the, for the Book of Mormon text that we have, not the lost part, the part we have, Joseph Smith doesn't actually use the plates or the interpreters.
Right.
The plates are wrapped up nearby in a cloth. He just leaves those alone. He takes his seer stone, takes his rock, puts it in his hat.
Right.
And, like, covers his face with his hat and looks in the dark. And reportedly there's, like, a spiritual light, right? He can sort of perceive the spiritual light better by blocking out the physical light.
Right.
Right. So in
First learned about that on South Park, by the way. The TV show,
yeah,
you know, the little part.
They have their narrative of the whole Book of Mormon translation and the manuscript theft and all that.
Yeah.
So they obviously are trying to ridicule this, and it's kind of an easy thing in some ways to ridicule, right? Because
sure.
like, I mean, a hat. Like, what do you do with a hat?
You
put it on your head, right?
Yeah.
You don't stick your face in it. I mean, that's like for people who are familiar with like the old Get Smart.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy series, mm-hmm. right? Like you've got this spy who his cell phone is in his shoe, right? So he like, it's comical because he's holding his shoe up to his ear and talking into a shoe. Well, that's ridiculous because a shoe is a very ordinary object that has a typical use and it's not talking into it,
right?
It's
right.
putting it on your foot. Well, a hat is a very ordinary object that has a typical use, and it's not sticking your face in it, right?
And giving you the principles of which God would like you to adhere to.
Right. And so people rightly find this odd, right? Mm. But what is Joseph Smith doing? Like, why is he doing this? So we have accounts saying he's trying to block out the light,
mm-hmm.
okay? But also, look at this narrative from Justice Smith Sr. about this Nephite seer. How does he use the interpreters? Well, he's got the interpreters in front of his eyes, but he veils his face. He puts something over his face. And in this case, it's an animal skin. Mm-hmm. So I took the trouble to try to figure out what we can know about Joseph Smith's hat. And there's one account that says what kind of hat it was specifically. It was a beaver skin hat.
Hmm.
So Joseph Smith is actually doing the exact same thing.
Interesting.
That the seer in this story is doing. He's covering his face with an animal skin.
Hmm.
So as odd as this seems to us, you know, stick your face in a hat, it's echoing things from, it's echoing Moses veiling his face when he comes down from Sinai. It's echoing this Book of Mormon, lost Book of Mormon narrative, mm-hmm. where the guy, when he's using the seeing instrument, he covers his face with an animal skin, just is doing the same thing,
yeah.
right? This is, I think, part of how he's understanding himself. He's seeing himself doing the same thing that prophets did anciently.
Yeah.
And then lastly, there are echoes here that I won't say too much about, but like of the temple. So remember,
sure.
the guy relating this story from Joseph Smith Sr., he's not Latter-day Saint. He's never been through the temple, right? But, like, there's this narrative where, like, in a temple context, in this tabernacle, they're, like, having this dialogue through a veil, mm-hmm. and the Lord asks him a question about his hand, and the guy says, I don't know, but I've come to inquire.
Yeah.
And, like, when I started seeing what's going on here, like my head exploded, right? Because I thought Joseph Smith doesn't know anything about the temple, the Nauvoo Endowment, until March of 1842 when he becomes a Freemason. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
We translate this in 1828. That's 14 years earlier.
Sure.
Why is there so much temple endowment in it already? You've got some of the structure of the endowment there. You also got it in the story of the brother of Jared.
Sure.
Actually, there's another dialogue through the veil, question about the guy's hand, guy's admitted in the presence of the Lord,
mm-hmm.
has things revealed to him that he can't disclose to other people, and so on, right? Several other temple parallels. And so this guy, Fayette Latham, interviews Joseph Smith Sr. He did not make this narrative up, either by accident or on purpose.
Right.
He got it from Joseph Smith Sr., and it came from the lost pages of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm. I love it. This is so much. I need to take a break real quick. When we come back in the third block, it's going to be pretty short. But I've got one question left that I want to ask you, and then we ask three questions of everyone who steps into the cultural hall.
Cool.
So I'll do that coming back in the third block.
Consumer alert! Consumer alert!
Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. There's an extremely insane computer infection called Zeus ZBot, infecting hundreds of thousands of computers across the world. This infection is super malicious because it puts you in danger by recording every keystroke you make into your computer, stealing your confidential information, including your banking passwords. You could be infected and never know until you have all your money sucked out of your bank account. At PC Laptops, we can help. If you think you've been infected or just want to be safe, please bring in your PC, no matter what brand it is, into any one of our locations right now, and we'll scan it for free. Why are we doing this for free? Because we want to impress you so much that if you or any of your friends need a computer, service, or phone repair, you come to PC Laptops first. Get into any one of our locations right now or check us out at PCLaptops.com. PC Laptops, where computers start at $7.99. PC Laptops, we love you!
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, remember, you can find us on any of the social media at The Cultural Hall. You find us wherever you social media-lize, and you can also send us an email, contact at theculturalhall.com if you want to have guest suggestions, anything like that. Also, if you like this episode or other episodes we've been doing recently, please be sure to give us a review for whatever that is from you. It means a lot to us to be able to hear that you're enjoying it, and it allows other people to know that you enjoy this as they look to find something to fill their entertainment needs. So I was doing a little perusing this morning about the lost 116 pages.
Yeah.
I saw one guy in particular who's like, I'm fine. I'll just read the Book of Mormon. I don't need your speculation and your, you know, all this. And I know that this next question that I'm going to ask you, it's so basic, but it also drives your work, is why do we need this book?
So like I mentioned earlier, what started this research for me was more than just curiosity about the part of the Book of Mormon that we don't have. It was wanting to understand the part of the Book of Mormon that we do have. And, you know, like I said, like if for any narrative, if we were missing a lot of the first part of the narrative, right, we wouldn't get a lot of the intended meaning that's there for the later part of the narrative. You know, when people want to, when we want to understand the scriptures, often we're encouraged to do like real study, right? And often people will look at commentaries. People recognize, like when we're, say, looking at the Bible, that we kind of got to know something about the culture of Jesus's time to really understand the significance of what he's saying. We need context, okay? Sure. So what is the context for the part of Mormon's abridgment that we have?
Right.
Well, the original context that Mormon intended for it was the first part of Mormon's narrative. We don't know what the first part of that is. We're at a loss to understand the part that we've got. So, like, for instance, there are times, I think Mormon's often doing this implicitly without saying that he's doing it. There's sometimes he's doing it explicitly. He's referring back to stuff that he said earlier, and he thinks we have that material, but we don't, because it got stolen. So in Mosiah chapter 11, he's telling the story about King Noah. King Noah has this tower built on this hill that was north of the land Shiloh. And then he drops in this detail. It was the same hill that was used as a resort by the children of Nephi at the time they fled out of the land. What in the world is he talking about? Like, he's saying this, like, you know, it's that same hill.
Yeah,
you know
that
hill.
You guys read about that in the first 116.
Right.
I'm not going to go on. I talk plenty about it.
He doesn't explain it because he thinks we already know it.
Right.
Well, he's our only source that we could know it through. So if he didn't tell it to us, we wouldn't know it.
Right.
He assumes we know it. That means he told it to us. So Mormon, sometimes we've got another thing like this in Alma chapter 10, where he talks about, you know, somebody was a descendant of Amminadi who interpreted the writing by the finger of God on the wall of the temple. What?
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Yeah, when's that story?
We're supposed to know that, okay? So these were, there are different things. If you look at the chronology, we can actually, both of these, we can tell he's talking about something that was in the Lost Pages period. He's obviously already mentioned it. We're supposed to know what was there. If we can take the different clues that are in the Book of Mormon text we've got, we can take things that various people said, right? Martin Harris's brother, Joseph Smith Sr., a couple statements from Joseph Smith himself that I've got in the book, right? Like other associates of Martin Harris, things from the early revelations of Joseph Smith. I mean, like, who's going to say, Joseph Smith's revelations, they're not relevant to understanding the Book of Mormon. What Joseph Smith said, whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
No one
Nobody says that, right? Yeah. Like, these aren't speculations, right? There's work that it takes to piece it together, like puzzle pieces, right? Like, let's say you've got 5,000-piece puzzle that you want to put together, but then, you know, tornado comes in, blows away, you know, 4,200 pieces. You've got 800 left. You're like, I got nothing better to do right now. I'm going to gather up these pieces that I can find and put them together. You'll never see the whole picture.
Right.
But you'll be able to piece together enough of them to start seeing what it's a picture of, right? Figure some things out. If we want to understand the Book of Mormon, and Mormon has a message he's trying to put across, but some of that message is difficult to get without piecing together the puzzle pieces that have been left to us, why not piece together the puzzle pieces that have been left to us, right?
Yeah.
So my understanding of the Book of Mormon has grown enormously through this work. And actually, in the conclusion to the book, that was the part, that was one of the parts I wrote last, and it flowed. I didn't actually originally expect to write a conclusion. I just started writing it, and it just kind of like flowed right out of my fingertips, right? Mm. Like, because I spent 15 years researching this, and there were so many things that I learned about the Book of Mormon as a whole, right, that like come together from the different narratives I'm able to piece together in the book. And so I wrote those, and some of those are things that helped me to come back to the church. So they, for me, have been powerfully faith-building, powerfully illuminating of the Book of Mormon. There are people who have written reviews, Philip Barlow, Daniel Peterson, Joe Spencer, a number of bloggers, a lot of Amazon reviewers, mm-hmm. and said, like, they've read this book just in the last couple months since it's been out, right? And they understand the Book of Mormon, we feel like, tremendously better now. Mm. So that's the point here, right? It's not, I think it's a fascinating sort of curiosity quest. It certainly has been for me, but it's more than that. Yeah. This is about understanding the Book of Mormon. And if we're Latter-day Saints, that's something we want to do.
Yeah. And that we've been commanded and asked, yeah. and, you know, yeah. Will better our lives. Because we'll get closer to God through that book than any other book,
right.
is the promise.
Right.
The three questions we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall are this. The first one is, do you have a calling right now? And if so, what is it?
So I am in a new ward right now. So not yet.
They'll get you.
I think that may actually be coming tonight. I have a meeting with the bishop tonight. So in my last ward in Provo, I was the gospel doctrine teacher for about 3 years.
Cool. If you could pick one for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
Oh, okay. If I could just pick one that exists, I'd do gospel doctrine teacher again. If I could make one up, you know, I really love talking with people who are wrestling with their faith because that's something that I understand really well. It's something that I get people contacting me actually out of the blue mm-hmm. with questions about faith, you know, sort of Facebook Messenger or something. And I find it really deeply fulfilling to talk with people about that. So maybe if I could do a sort of designing a calling, I mean, I'd love to just be able to, you know, talk with people who are wrestling with questions and see what, you know, light I can help with.
Yeah. There's a need for that for sure. So hopefully, whether official or non, you can continue to fulfill that. The last question that we ask everyone is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith. You know, offhand, I think I would say like the incredible expansiveness of the Restoration. So Joseph Smith had these statements that he made toward the end of his life in Nauvoo. And here's the founder of the faith, and he's trying to kind of encapsulate, he's trying to sum up the faith, right? And he says once, it is one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism to receive truth, let it come from where it may. Hmm. So that means like wherever there's truth, anywhere, like, it belongs to us. Like, we're supposed to seek it out. We're supposed to find it. Like, truth is truth,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, we're not commanded to be narrow, right, to be closed. Just the opposite, right?
Right.
Like, what's the goal? Like, we're supposed to become like God. I mean, like, how do you do that by just being like, yeah, I'm just going to be, like, really closed and narrow, like, to be like God, you ultimately have to know everything, right?
Right, like, right.
And so, but that's what we're called to, right? So there's this tremendous expansiveness, this tremendous openness to truth.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. Thank you so much. The name of the book is The Lost 116 Pages, Reconstructing the Book of Mormon's Missing Stories. The author, Don Bradley. There's a link for it in association with this episode at theculturalhall.com, or you can get it from Greg Coford Books at gregcoford.com or anywhere you purchase books on the internet. We hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat. On the back row, we really